Hello.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Hi.
Well, I just thought.
You just started.
We might as well.
You just started.
As we're doing things.
Okay.
It's raining. It has rained.
It has rained.
Two and a half weeks, basically, without any rain.
Yeah. Or maybe 3 weeks.
Maybe 3 weeks.
Maybe three. It kind of, yeah. It has been very dry.
It's getting me a bit agitated, to be honest. I think in that British way of like, I need some weather to think about. That weather bit of my brain's getting lazy and just going like, I'll just do that tomorrow.
Just nothing to talk about, yeah.
Right. Oh, not necessarily to talk about, but just being like, it's weird to be so confident that like, oh, yeah, just leave that out in the garden.
Yeah.
All like, oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Just maybe. Yeah, sure. I don't need to know. I'm not really worried about where my jumper is. Like, that's the most British thing. So I was concerned. Mm. I wasn't concerned where my jumper was.
And that concerned you.
And that concerned me. People in other countries listening to this are going to be like,
what?
What are you on about? But jumper concern is actually
a real concern.
Part of our national heritage is jumper concern.
Yeah.
You know, are you going out without a jumper? Where is your jumper? God forbid you leave it in the car and then you should be stranded somewhere without your jumper.
Heaven forfend.
Yeah. Could be 32 degrees outside. Still, British people need to know where their jumpers are. Mm. And we do now because it's raining.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. And we said today, didn't we? It's a very altruistic feeling of feeling glad for the wildlife and for the fauna that it's going to rain. The flora and fauna needed the rain.
Yeah.
And so I was pleased for them. Ever saw somebody complaining, though, that it's the start of the summer holidays as it's chucking it down, which is very true.
Yes. Lots of people at our session were like, we're going camping now in the rain.
In the rain?
It's fine, though, isn't it? It never rains all day, that's the thing. When you're outdoors, you realise that very seldom does it rain all day. And when it does, it's very memorable.
Yeah, very, very memorable. Yeah, and you know, you just deal with it, don't you?
Yeah.
We do. But we're in for another... We're going to shorten this one, I think. So we're going to do quick bird quiz for you.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk about... We're going to talk about a summer reading list for people.
Yeah.
Because everybody's about to go off and presumably do their forest school summer holiday clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, you know what people need is a load of stuff to read.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, a load of stuff to
Some people might be going on holiday too.
You might want to sit in your hammock and read something about the job that you do the rest of the year.
Mm.
That's what you want to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about...
Of course.
From memory, most influential, is that what you've gone for?
I've just gone for books that I like.
Books that you
books
like?
Books I like.
That's very nice.
I was going to talk about summer bow drop.
Oh, yeah, go on, because that's scared the life out of us.
Yeah, so we were camping here the other night, and just after everybody had gone to bed, down the bottom of the hill, beforehand there was a small crack.
Yeah, there was lots of creaking and
cracking, and then there was a big thump and a huge limb of sweet chestnut had fallen.
I reckon it was about a foot across at the base of it.
Yeah, and it had just gone, and obviously, fortunately, nowhere we didn't pitch our tents underneath any trees that would do that. But I think a lot of people know about beach summer drop. So it's when it's been particularly hot and dry that. Older trees just decide to sacrifice a limb for the sake of the whole tree and can go without warning. But I wasn't aware that sweet chestnut did it as well.
And oak. Oak also does it in dry spells.
So sycamore
does. We did look up as well, didn't we? And we found out that it was partly to do with canopy weight.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily self-sacrificial. It can sometimes be that because they've had such a big leafing that it becomes heavy and what might already be weakened or diseased. Or, you know.
So, yeah, if you have a moment to do a bit of a...
Do a site check.
Inspection. There is quite a nice online little guide. I've forgotten what it's called, but it's called something like Signs of... I can't remember. Signs of decay in trees or tree assessment. I can't remember. Sorry, I should have prepared that a bit better. But yeah, how to identify bits that are risky.
Well, I've heard lots of people have told me that they listen to this podcast while they're packing down or setting up for sessions. So maybe interspersed with all our podcasts now, we should just go, whoa.
Yeah.
Just to get people on edge to make sure that they know that there might be a true... What?
Just make some fake noises.
I've left this bird book wide open. Did you look at the paper that was on? Oh, that's very honest of you. Okay. Are you ready for your first one?
I am. I bet you've chosen, like, beach birds or something.
Huh?
Are they all woodland birds?
You'll know. I only chose birds that you and I have talked about.
No, that really sets me up for failure, then.
No, it doesn't.
Blackbird.
Didn't even need 2 seconds of it. There's more sounds to that.
Get away from me!
That's all blackbirds.
Mm.
Wide range there of blackbirds. You're on one for one.
I saw a thrush, cousin of blackbird.
Did you know?
I did. Maybe I said this last week. If I did, I'm sorry. But my cat was harassing a fledgling of a thrush the other day, and not in a particularly serious way, but the parent bird was so amazingly brave. I'm imagining it was the mother, but she just sort of like went for my cat, basically, and was sitting in front of her, making herself as big as possible, and scolding like that. My cat was just like, what? You're supposed to be running away from me. And the fledgling was almost as big as its parent and in the shrubbery. And I'd never seen it before. I was amazed. So it's like, get away from my baby! Going for it. Anyway, yes.
Okay. This one only has one noise.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Should we look at it again?
I know. That's a pheasant.
Yes. Common noise in British woodland.
Yeah.
Well, it's, kind of cops. It goes in the fields, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing.
It goes in the field.
It goes in the field and makes the... I'm always impressed at what a... I always think of pheasants as like an absolute feat of like human engineering. Just that like, because humans like have a hunting season for pheasants and have managed to breed this bird that is like completely the wrong colour. Mm. It's like if you went like, oh, we're going to get bright orange parrots and we're going to breed them to live in woods just for us to hunt.
Mm.
And then because they'd only hunt them in certain times of the year, the rest of the year, they're the most bolshy little birds. Mm. Just like, no fear of anything. Just stood in the middle of a field, making a load of noise, What?
Yeah.
I'm just here, mate. I'm just here. Right, you're bright red.
Yeah.
Like, everyone can see you. Me? A poncy tail coming out the back. What, me? Walking around? Yeah. Have a bit of decorum. Be a like, animal in the world. So it's what I can, only what I imagine, you know, people say, I don't know what island it was, but where they made the dodo go extinct because it just like stood completely still and was like, hi. Like, I feel like pheasants have only avoided that by being useful to like rebreed.
Right.
They're essentially the same bird of like.
Where are they from? Are they India, like chickens?
Where are they from? I should have looked that up.
There's lots of different types of pheasants as well, aren't there?
Yeah.
My friend's got some silver pheasants. They're very beautiful.
No, it's gone now. It's gone forever. Okay, you ready for your next
one? I want some. Go back to pheasants in a bit and tell me some pheasant facts.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah.
Okay. And. You looked a little bit smug because I was giving you easy ones, and so I thought...
It's a woodpecker, but I've got to tell which one it is, have I?
Actually, it's a superb lyrebird.
No!
Pretending to be a woodpecker. It is one of the woodpeckers.
It's what? Can you play it again, please? Play the song again, please.
Okay, so would you like a clue?
Yeah,
okay.
I think...
Okay, so here's your clue, which I wasn't aware of. It's because I've got both pages of woodpecker in front of me.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the woodpeckers is in all of England and Scotland.
Mm.
One of them is only in England, according to this map.
Mm.
This one is only in England. This is the one that doesn't go to Scotland. So if there's any people listening in Scotland, they're going to be like, what is that crazy bird?
Mm. Well, I think it is probably a green woodpecker, but I thought green woodpecker is a bit more like, whoop, 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 whoop. It has more of a swooping downward tone to it. But I've never
maybe
heard...
Maybe that's because they're going away from you. Maybe it's
or
the...
Or maybe it's just our one in particular that lives here. Is
there's
a bit
like
more
two or three that live here.
A yaffle. Am I right? Is it a green one or is it a spotted one?
It's a lesser spotted woodpecker.
Bum bums, okay.
Yeah. No bigger than a sparrow.
Ah. Are they, and they're rarer than greater ones? Yes, and more scruffy.
Sorry, I was just reading the bit that said they have a compact, stout little body and a rounded head. And I thought, I know a lot of people describe as a stout little body and a rounded head.
Yes, all the best type of people.
All the best types of people.
Yeah. Yeah. They are rarer though, aren't they, those ones, than the big ones?
Yes, hence lesser spotted.
No, lesser meaning smaller.
What is that what
who's
it means?
Who's that over there? Wren. Wonder if they can hear that on the podcast.
I hope not. It would be confusing for Bird Quiz, which is our...
Well, that's probably why she's annoyed, because you're playing woodpecker sounds, and she's like, don't you give my babies! Get away!
Maybe.
Because woodpeckers eat baby birds and eggs.
Ready?
Yep.
That's not a bird. That's just Gemma.
Ooh.
So you can't see it, but Gemma's face contorted in about eight different ways.
It's either a thrush or a nightingale.
Would you like to listen to it again?
Yeah. It's a thrush. Yeah.
It is a song thrush.
Yes. And the good way to remember the song thrush is because they repeat phrases they like, so they just kind of like ad lib a bit, but they obviously are going, oh, I like that one. So, woo-hoo, woo-hoo.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
That one. Okay. Now I've gone slightly off piste with the last one.
Flamingo.
Oh, do you know what?
Penguin.
I couldn't even attempt what a flamingo must sound like. Is that what you think a flamingo sounds like?
I don't know.
Is that going to be your guess? I mean, I'm not going to look it up now because I've got one. Right.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah. What the heckins is that?
And?
What the heck? That is not a woodland bird. What is it?
Oh, it's not a woodland bird.
Oh.
Would you like to know?
Is it like a guillemot?
Can I give you some?
Is it a guillemot?
Can I give you some clues?
It sounds like an orc. Go on.
Clues.
Is it a razorbill?
It's not a razorbill. It is an aquatic bird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got that much. That's okay. Why I kept saying guillemot and razorbill.
No.
Orc.
The male. Oh, you might know this. This might give it away completely.
Puffin.
The males are called cobs.
A swan?
Yeah. That is a mute swan.
That's a swan?
That is a mute swan.
Whoa.
I'm going to show you the book.
That is like the type of swan you see all the time, like on
yeah,
the canal.
Yeah, that's the type
but
of swan.
I've never heard
and then
of that before. Go on.
This is the noise that a mute swan makes.
Wow. Gosh.
So, it says here that they're by no means mute, but they don't have far carrying voices, so they can't call to each other long distances. They quite often give grunts or explosive snorts and hissing sounds.
Mm.
Now, this may be again another piece of deep British culture. Have you heard about swans breaking people's arms?
Always. Every time. Watch out for the swan that breaks your arm.
Break your arm, mate. Your arm.
Yeah.
Does it come from somewhere? I would be interested to know, because Canada has lots of geese.
Geese are different to swans, though.
Yeah, but same,
swans
like...
Swans are way bigger and more violent. Although, we do have a bit of, I think probably cine film footage of my cousin being bitten on the bum by a goose. And then she starts running, she's like three, and then the goose is chasing her, like flapping its wings, but still holding onto the clothing of her bum. And like everyone, instead of helping my cousin, are just like,
ah, just pissing
film
themselves.
Film it. Yeah. So geese can be quite vicious too. But I have encountered a swan with cygnets on the canal getting out of the water onto the towpath and being like, back off. So
yeah, we went
scary.
To I want to say it's called like Abbotsbury Swanery.
Yeah.
And there's loads of them, and it's a very interesting place. If you want to look up Abbotsbury Swanery
in Dorset,
it's an old monastery where like the monks basically the swans used to come and nest there anyway, and then the monks were like, cool, we're gonna make a monastery here and like keep the swans sort of in that weird human way of like, oh, we'll keep them safe. And then they started eating all the swans in a massive feast every year. So it's a swan's nesting ground.
I'm sure I saw something on Tudor Monastery Farm. Have you ever watched that before?
No.
It's a very good program. There was one about medieval Christmas, and there was something about like,
oh, they used
religious
to stuff
people
a swan. Yeah.
Eating swans at Christmas, because it was like the one time they were allowed to eat it.
Right.
Eat meat or something like that. Something to do with religious monks and nuns eating swans. There's a thing about it at Christmas. So maybe that's where they got them all from.
Maybe, yeah. And it was quite interesting. They keep them in a pen. They move the cygnets by hand. They like sedate. I don't know how they do it, but they put the cygnets in little enclosures that are probably half the size of this thing. And the parents walk and follow them in, but then can't leave because they can't get a long enough run up to take flight.
Right.
So there's no like walls on these pools or anything. It's just there, and the swans are looking at you like, well, I can't leave now until like a person comes and picks me up and puts me in the sea, and then I can run and take off.
Right.
Yeah, kind of sad. But that's bird quiz.
Bird quiz.
Bird quiz!
Kazoo break. Our courses are so great.
Are you really doing it?
No.
Oh, God. Right. Our courses are great, though. We've got four courses coming up in the next year. We've got cooking, we've got storytelling, music and drama, we've got an introduction to whittling, and we've got an outdoor CPD day. And they're all very easily accessible things. And what we're trying to focus on with them is we've got quite a scope of knowledge in all, as I say, depth of knowledge to each of those subjects. That's why we're not doing just any random subjects, it's those particular ones. And the idea being that we've said we want to, when people book in, we ask them to write a little bit about, you know, what their background is, because we want to tailor those courses to the people that are coming. So if you have already made spoons and you turn up and we've got loads of people that have already made spoons, then we're not going to sit there and teach you to make spoons. We'll go, right, here's some other stuff we've got in the woods, let's explore that, let's make this personalised learning. So as you probably know from listening to the podcast, we're very into personalised learning and learner-led curriculums. And so that's exactly what our teaching courses are. We will meet you wherever you are, not geographically, you need to come to us. But we will meet you spiritually and skill-wise where you are, and through the day go on a bit of a journey together and extend some things.
And therefore, anybody like, people involved in Forest School or people who work with children, and some of them are, to be honest, open to just parents or people who have an interest. So, especially the cooking one. In fact, all of them, really. If you just like have an interest in telling stories or making music outdoors.
Or cooking or eating.
Cooking. If you like eating, I would definitely recommend the cooking course. If you like playing around with an old stick, or actually a new stick, then I recommend the whittling one. And it's all about play. They're very playful, fun courses, light-hearted, nice. It's a nice day.
There is
coffee and tea and biscuits as well.
Brilliant.
That's very important. There's always biscuits.
Right. Shall we get back to the main waffle then? Are you going to play again?
Wait. Wait.
Okay.
Book list, summer reading list. A book that I have been... So I've listened to quite a few books on Audible, non-fiction books, and one that I'm really liking is called Wonderland, A Year of Britain's Wildlife by Brett Westwood and Stephen Moss. And I've actually got it in paperback and on Audible, and it's good. It's done by month, and they're two friends who are naturalists, and so each day in, you know, July, you can just listen, and it'll be something that they've noticed or observed. It's everything from insects to birds. And that's quite good, because if you are listening to it or reading that chapter, then it'll often be about something that you will happen to then observe that month, so you can like learn in little snippets. Mm-hmm. Quite good.
I would recommend, I don't know if it's a paper book, but I have listened to a book that's recently come out called The Science of Storytelling, which is a fantastic book. It's about, so it started with a guy who did a whole book about radicalism and how, you know, the presumption that it must be stupid people to get radicalized, yeah. And then actually looked into it, and it was mostly people with a very high IQ, and how do we... It's turned out that it was all... A lot of it was to do with, like, narrative and story, and being told a certain narrative to... Mm-hmm. to that reinforced a worldview. And so then this guy went and looked really in-depth at storytelling. It's not so much storytelling in the way that we mean it, as, like, you stand up and this is how you... perform it, or this is how you do storytelling, but it is a lot about if you were writing a play or a story and character development, and it's useful to, I found it useful when I'm telling a story, to think about, so things like, well, have I given you enough of a reason to root for this character, or you know, sometimes we've talked about really being in physically in that world, but this book has challenged me to really get mentally inside those characters, to go not just like, oh, Hansel put the breadcrumbs down because that's what he did, like, I want to be like, what is Hansel's motive, like, if I could interview him, I feel like I could ask him a lot more questions, and then that comes across in, then you go, well, I've got all that now that I can put into my story if I choose to, or I might not choose to, or you know,
good. Yeah, that sounds
so good. That I think if anybody is interested in storytelling, that's a good one to go and have a little look at.
Yeah. It's not really anything to do with forest school, really, but I loved listening to The Stopping Places, A Journey Through Gypsy Britain by Damien Labar, which is narrated by him, and is really lovely. He's born into a Romani family, but they've been settled for quite a long time by the time he's born, and so he feels a bit lost in terms of whether he is Romani or not, and so he decides to go and basically live in his van and visit a lot of the stopping places that his family visited, and then further afield. And it's just, I think it's a very, very atmospheric, very much about being outdoors in Britain and in France, as well, and that's, it's very good. Got another one?
Yeah, I would say I'm very much deep. It's another sort of storytelling one, but the Stephen Fry's Mythos and his other one, I think it's Heroes, Monsters, Heroes and Adventurers or something. So Mythos is all the start of the Greek creation myths, Zeus and Poseidon and Hades and all of that things, which I started listening to, and I found it too culturally entrenched for my, it would be fine to listen to as for me as an adult with some background in Greek, you know, history, and I can follow what's going on, but wasn't useful as a, like, hey, I can pick out some stories to retell. But the Heroes, Adventurers and Monsters, or whatever it was, is the chapters are much more broken up, and it's the stories of Hercules and the stories of Perseus, and he does a fantastic thing where he does different accents for the different characters, but he only does accents from Great Britain. So Hercules has got a West Country accent, and King Agamemnon is from, I think, the Midlands. And so to a British ear, it doesn't sound, I mean, I'm sure he could do Greek accents, and to my ear it would be like, oh, that's probably Greek, but it seems a little bit more culturally sensitive to kind of go, okay, let's reimagine that here. And also it's interesting, it does sort of throw up ideas. So Hercules has a West Country accent. Immediately in my head he became more stupid because that's what the West Country accent does, or you know, the king Agamemnon is very kind of downbeat because that's the that was a really bad Midlands accent. Do you know what I do if I channel the Midlands is I just become Neil from The Good Ones, from the Young Ones.
Yeah,
that's it's that and Frank Skinner that I pull in. But yeah, so I would recommend that. It's very, very long. I think it's about 16 hours all in all. So one to really, maybe if you're going on holiday, one to sink your teeth into.
It's a bit old now, lots of people read it, but The Salt Path by Raina Wynne, another kind of travel-y one about Raina and her husband walking the whole of the Southwest Coast Path when they find themselves homeless after a bit of a sort of life tragedy. Very good, very
engrossing. Tell me some more things.
It's sort of about like facing adversity and just doing something just for the sake of it. So they just set out on the Southwest Coast Path with hardly anything, and they don't have any money, so they are living each day on, I don't know how much money, but literally they are buying super noodles
or, right,
and that's what they're living on, and they're world camping and they've got nowhere to live. So it's an insight into because they're like very, very middle class, have been doing up this amazing farmhouse in Wales and using it as a holiday business, and then find themselves with nowhere to live. And so they meet people along the way who are like, oh yeah, don't put the coast path in your retirement. And they're kind of like, actually, and whenever they reveal that they're homeless, she sort of describes the reaction of people who sort of back away. And so she finds herself learning about homelessness and
stigmas and things like
completely.
That.
And really nice kind of nature observation and what it's like to just live outside for a very long time. And you know, those things that you might think, oh, I'd love to do that someday, but
right,
and it's very much about like, yeah, there are, there's always gonna be buts to things. That sounds rude.
Oh, you were going on a real tactful line there.
Just do it anyway. So, you know, they don't have very much specialist gear. So it might be like, oh, I'd love to do that, but I don't have like proper walking boots and I can't really afford. I just have a bit of a luxury to buy those.
Do you think it would challenge that class idea that we've talked about in other podcasts? Would it be a bit of an antithesis to that, to kind of...
Maybe, yeah.
Just in what you've just said there, that does sound like the anti... You know, them... Going and doing it and saying, oh, maybe we'll do it without budget gear, with budget gear, and what does that look like, and those sort of things.
And even if you're thinking about doing something that isn't necessarily a physical challenge, but it's just a thing, and then you think, oh, no, it's not possible, and then you go, actually, for a long time, humans have been doing stuff with just stuff that's around them. You don't have to wait for the perfect time. Just go for it. So it's very inspiring in that way.
Ideal. Just so that I can indoctrinate people over the summer, because... I'm imagining after we come back with the summer, next year, next academic year, I am going to goad you into a school versus disillusionment debate. And so I would like to get everybody on my side. So please could everybody read Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling by John Taylor Gatto. It is very American-centric.
Right.
So there's lots of things that to a European audience... you can kind of go, because America is essentially a toddler as a country. Let's just be real British about this, right? You're so new that it's easy to trace back. I just mean in terms of, you know, it's more easy to trace back. This was when the school system started.
So you're not actually being rude about America.
Oh, I am intentionally, but but it's. It's because it's later in history, it's more easily documented that this person started this school and these people signed to make this an agreement that is more difficult in European history because we've got some, and so it goes longer. I'm just giving me really scathing looks. I don't know why. But he is an incredible book, and he is he was an award-winning teacher for 20 odd years. And then started to sort of question it all and So it's interesting to have it written, because I think there's lots of books that are pro-home ed or anti-state schooling that are written by people who don't necessarily have an in-depth background, but as a teacher who, not only was he a teacher, he was one of the system's best teachers. And then he's talking about how he started to undermine it and how he started to work within it. And
so, and does he talk about an alternative?
Yes.
What does he suggest?
Well, I don't want to spoil it, because I think it's one of those books where if I...
Does he just say everyone should homeschool, or does he talk about alternative schools?
No, he does talk about how you can be an alternative educator.
Okay, cool.
So not necessarily that school should exist, but these are some of the systems that he thinks should be put in place.
Okay.
But I would say it's something where if you just skip to the last chapters and read them, you wouldn't perhaps have the grounding. Whereas if you work through it chapter by chapter and you start to realise he unpicks that and unpicks why that's a problem and, and says why that, and then presents this alternative that meets all the things that he's addressed earlier on. So I would recommend that one.
We've both just finished listening to Ruby Wax's No Brainer,
haven't we? Oh my god, incredible.
So good.
Incredible.
And so funny. Like, all about the brain.
And the most accessible way I've ever heard anybody talk about neuroscience.
Yeah.
And just, I wish there were more. So we've said before, watching anybody who is passionate and skilled in their area of expertise is incredible. It doesn't matter if that person is, it's a bit like, you know, those videos that get shared around Facebook and it's some, like an Asian chef who can cut noodles incredibly well, or you know, somebody who can I don't know, do dotted fabric incredibly fast. Just watching someone who is passionate and skilled in a niche area is incredible.
Yeah.
And that's, I wish there were more people who could make high level academia accessible, like Ruby Wax has done in that book.
So she's interviewing a series of neuroscientists and
monks
and
mindfulness advocates.
Teachers,
all kinds of things.
So there, and
students.
There's chapters on aging and death and the teenage brain and mindfulness,
depression,
lots of things. And it is, how the brain works, and lots of bits that have made me laugh so hard I nearly crashed the car. That was the only downside, I would say. when she's talking about doing stand-up in front of a lot of Russian oligarchs when she's in a bit of a dark, depressed hole herself.
Yes.
Made me, cry and nearly wet myself.
It is one of those books, though, that I nearly turned it off straight, like, 2 minutes into it for no reason other than... So I've read lots of books...
You've read lots of books.
Shut your face. Right. We've talked before about, like, essentialism and I really like minimalism and narrowing down, and I'm all for that. And I first started listening to it when I was clearing this tree that had been cut down. So I was moving the sticks and I was like, right, sit that on, do whatever. And I think 2 minutes in, it says something like, you know, the best thing for your brain is just to focus purely on one task and not have distractions. And I just kind of went, oh, fuck this then.
Yeah.
And like, and I was like, no, listen to the book and then apply it in other ways. But it was kind of like at the start, it was saying like, don't actually do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't do what you're doing. I loved all the stuff about neuroplasticity.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So you're not fixed. And it's really, really hopeful. You know, it's like, whatever your brain gives its attention to is what molds it. It's a very empowering idea that you can choose to change your brain. And I'm sure that probably lots of outdoorsy folk will have noticed that effect on their brain and themselves. Like, somebody emailed us the other day, didn't they, saying that forest school had like completely changed their life.
Changed
them as a parent, changed them as a human being. And you might argue that that is because of the fact that your brain is giving its attention to something completely different from your previous life, being outdoors in nature.
The Hidden Life of Trees.
Yes, and The Inner Life of Animals.
Oh, I haven't read that one. I was really
excited.
Same
author. Peter von Leeuwen.
Okay. Well, I can talk about Hidden Life of Trees because that is one of the best anthropomorphizing of the flora that I have ever read, and not in a patronizing way. It's not, or not patronizing. I think there's one way of anthropomorphizing where you're going, and Mother Oak sends her children down. And that works for some people and is going to turn some people right off. But this book is very, talks about trees and plants and what they're doing in a very scientific way, but also in a very in a way that has a narrative. Everything yeah. leads into the next bit and has whatever. And that is a book that I couldn't look at work in the same way while I was reading it. And since yeah. I have been very much in a different sort of. I feel different when I'm in Woodland now, having read that book and knowing how much is going on that I'm not aware of and that I can't perceive
yeah.
because,
yeah.
you know, it's kind of like you needed it to be written down because so much of what Flora does is spread on such a different timeline that you could spend 30 years in a woodland, you know, in the same woodland every day, but that is a heartbeat in terms of the lifetime of some trees. And so you need that collective wisdom of generations to go, right, we've noticed this about trees. Just so you know, they're very slowly doing this over the next 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And you kind of go,
yeah. Oh, moving north, is it?
All moving north, slowly moving north.
And I keep wanting to call them like the tree community since yes. reading it, you know? It's not like that tree. Like they are, yeah. They are a community.
Mm.
Like
and it's made me feel more sorry for, they were talking about plantation trees that are yeah. grown in individual pots and how they don't develop the root systems or the fungi to talk to other trees, so they can be geographically very
close.
They're
like dysfunctional teenagers.
Yeah, they're like feral. They don't yeah. know how to talk to, and that's why they fall down and why plantations are a bit more dangerous and it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Very, very
interesting. I have to say, I did go through a bit of a phase of like, but we can't use any of the wood for the fire.
Yeah.
do not, yeah. Don't ever chop a tree down, ever.
Yeah. Tell me about the animals one.
The animals one, I would say, is not as good, but is still good. The little blurb is like, can horses feel shame? Do deer grieve? Why do roosters deceive hens? We tend to assume that we are the only living things able to experience feelings. Have you ever wondered what's going on in an animal's head? So it's kind of little scientific experiments that have been done that prove that animals can have greater emotions than your average person might give them credit for. I think probably I didn't find it as amazing because I was slightly like, well, of course.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there were definitely some like interesting and surprising facts in there.
Right.
But I think maybe if you're already a bit of a naturey person,
yeah.
then you probably tend to confer quite a lot of emotion upon animals that maybe isn't
yeah.
even there. Like, you might even go further than the book does, type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still good. It's a good, yeah. good little listen.
I would like to recommend Flo, Living at the Peak of Your Abilities by Nilay Csikszentmihalyi.
Is that actually how you say his name?
Nilay Csikszentmihalyi.
If you learned how to say it.
Well, because I listened to the audiobook. So I've heard lots of people say his name, but would you
right.
like to see it written down?
No, I've seen it written down, yeah.
It's got 9 versions of the alphabet in it.
Yeah.
9,000 letters.
Yeah.
Nilay Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's incredible, and it is, I think, very related to Forest School and that sensation of flow. Because the more you academically understand flow, the better you will be as a facilitator for flow for others.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can see the cues, but also you can set things up in motion and you can kind of identify in a different way than just going like, oh, that was great. They were all just really like going with it today.
Mm.
And we talked before about the, you know, the importance of academia and how that actually
theory
and that does actually make your practice better.
Yeah.
You know, there are some people that might just turn their nose up at it and go, oh, it's I've just been doing it 30 years and I just know. But actually being academic enough to look at it in pieces and go right
Completely.
Means that you're slightly more of a mechanic, I think, in terms of during a session you're more tuned into that needs more, you know, that needs quicker feedback for you, or actually you need something that's slightly easier because you're not quite in your optimum zone of challenge and all these things. So I would definitely say Flo, Nilay Csikszentmihalyi, is, yeah, an incredible book.
Another book that I've read, which is by him and somebody else, which is something about like working with teenagers, which is similar, which
right.
is really good. I can't remember the name of it.
He is a credit on lots of other flow.
Yeah.
He is the guy.
He came up with the term, didn't he?
Yeah.
Should we do? Can I do? Have you got any more? Because I was going to do two books that are about to come out.
Yeah, can I do one more?
Of course.
That's an old book, which is, I wonder if I can find it now. It's Eckhart Tolle, and it is Not the Power of Now, which is the one lots of, if you've heard of Eckhart Tolle, you've heard of The Power of Now. That's his kind of big book. But I would say the book that he did before that, A New Earth, Awakening Your Life's Purpose, is a much more interesting read. I don't know if you remember, about 2 years ago, my brain fell apart. Because I just was like,
I know, you'd say things what? And I'd go, Eckhart Tolle, and you were like, yeah.
I don't understand. You know, it's an incredible book for building your sense of self and what you can build it on, and you know, the sort of illusions that you might be under because you've been raised in a certain society or whatever else. But it is a book that breaks you down before it can build you back up. So the first, I would say, half of the book is it systematically picking everything you probably thought you knew about yourself apart and going, nah.
Oh my god.
And then starting to be like, right,
so you have to be in a bit of a solid place in order to read it. Don't read it maybe
no.
when you're feeling wobbly.
Read it when you're feeling wobbly, because eventually it will bring you out of it so much better.
Okay.
Go on then.
So Critical Issues in Foreign Schools, edited by Mark Sackville Ford and Helen Davenport, is coming out in August. I think. So that would be a good read. A few Forest School people writing chapters in there. And The Play Cycle, Theory, Research and Application by Gordon Sturrock, who recently passed away sadly, and Dr. Pete King, which is updated research and stuff on the play cycle, having found that loads of play workers don't understand, and people who work with children don't understand the play cycle at all. So they've kind of updated a few bits of it with Gordon Sturrock's blessing, and that would be geek
real,
central.
Real lots academia.
Lots of Venn diagrams about play. Love it.
Yeah.
I'm gonna rub my thighs. I'm rubbing my thighs right now. Lovely geeky things on the play cycle. Delicious.
So those two are coming out.
But if you can't be asked to read them, I reckon we'll probably read them and then do a podcast on it. So
yeah.
We will.
We'll get there and we'll
give us a time,
pick it
time.
Apart if you haven't got the time.
Yeah.
And tell you why you should make the time.
Yeah.
Most likely.
Yeah.
So if you have any books, you listener, not you Gemma, I'm not talking to you. You listener, have any books that you go, oh my god,
they
should definitely know about that. Or do you know what? I think this would put a cat amongst a pigeon. This disagrees with everything Lewis and Gemma says. This is why children should be sat in rows inside staring at a screen.
Oh, definitely loads of our listeners are going to think that. So
yeah, send me that book. The book that says...
Yeah, email us at childrenoftheforest@outlook.com or Facebook us or whatever, and tell us books that you've made your year, changed your practice, or even just that you've enjoyed as people who've probably got interests in common. And other listeners.
It's our summer holidays too. We want to
send
us some lovely things.
Yeah.
That'd be brilliant.
About to be the Whole Brain Child, aren't we?
Whole Brain Child.
By Dan Siegel.
That's the one that's coming
straight out. Started it. Very good. Anyway.
Right.
Bye.
Bye.